Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, our writer Jimmy Israel with us from Cleveland. Arsalan Iftikhar, senior editor of the Islamic Monthly, with us from Chicago. From Boston, Neil Minkoff. He's a healthcare consultant and a contributor to National Review magazine. And in Washington, D.C., Corey Date, contributing editor for The Root. That's an online publication that focuses on issues of particular interest to African Americans. Take it away, Jimmy.
Hey, Michelle. Thank you. And how you doing?
Well, I'm fine. Thank you for asking.
Good. And fellas, welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Hey. What's cracking?
What up, though?
Hey, man. Well, you know what? This could be word to Fatta Hubbard. This could be a game changer for college football. This week, players at Northwestern University, they won the right to be classified as employees, meaning they can unionize, Michelle.
Well, you know, it is a first step, but it's a big step because apparently it was quite unexpected. I mean, the regional chapter of the National Labor Relations Board in Chicago made the ruling. The director concluded that players are, in fact, employees as they had contended because their scholarships are tied to football performance. The players commit a huge amount of time to that activity, and Northwestern collects a large amount of money in football revenue. And so they concluded it is, in fact, a commercial enterprise. So
that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Thanks for that, Michelle.
Yeah,
you know,
so what do you think?
I come from a union family, you know, so I'm all about that. And with all the wear and tear on the body, cash on the back and front, and for everybody but the people on the field, I say giddy up. Corey Date, now you played a little football. For what I understand, a lot of football, actually.
I was going to say, he said when you said a little football, he's like, what are you trying to say?
Right. No shots. No shots, C-Date. No shots. You know, did you feel like an employee, bro?
Yeah, and I played a lot of football, but it was mainly in practice. I didn't see the field on Saturdays, but you know when you're at a highly competitive football program, you are putting in anywhere from 30 to 50 hours a week on your team, whether it's rehab, film study, practice. And let me tell you something: the NCAA limits on how many hours you can practice per day, how much time you can put together per week or per month or whatever, it's all blown every day. They don't adhere to it. And to me, what's interesting is if this holds up, first of all, this is going to be debated before the NLRB in courts for years to come. Okay, they're not going to go away quietly, Northwestern or the NCAA. But if this holds, this would fundamentally put a crack in the dam of the NCAA's exploitation of athletes. I mean, these athletes aren't getting a fair compensation. Many of them aren't even able to really pursue academics as aggressively as they may want. And once their eligibility runs out, they can't continue to get their education.
Let me clarify one thing. The thing about this that I found noteworthy is that the players who pursued this at Northwestern said they weren't necessarily pursuing compensation. What they were pursuing is a seat at the table. They want to have some say in their working conditions.
They want better medical coverage, benefits. They want concussion specialists. They want better concussion testing. And they want a trust fund that allows them to get their education after their athletic eligibility runs out.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Dr. Neil, I know you said before that you think this is a good move. Do you see any downside?
Oh, there's unintended consequences to everything. I mean, I think that this was an interesting first step, but we're a really long way away from there being anything close to a true union or players association, and that's for a whole bunch of reasons. So as already been mentioned, this has to go to the National Labor Relations Board for further vetting or can be appealed to it. But is it just for Northwestern? Will other schools start to unionize? Would it have to be one collective Division I union so that one union can't throw a game to another union? Would it be, there's a whole lot of downstream ramifications. Does it also apply to other sports where maybe, you know, I doubt that the track and field team is practicing as many hours a day at a lot of universities as the football team? Would it apply to those? And for the love of God, how would they strike? You know, how would the school just be able to lock them out and kick them out of their dorm rooms? And what would the rules be about that? I mean, we're a long way away from this action being something, this decision being something actionable to actually protect student athletes.
Wow. Arsalan Iftikhar, now you're the man with the plan and the law degree in the shop. Northwestern said it will appeal the decision. Do you think it will pass through the courts?
Well, it's really interesting because the regional director here in Chicago of the NLRB, Peter Sung Orr, who actually wrote the decision, actually wrote a really, really good and sound legal decision. So again, he based his conclusion primarily on the enormous revenue of about $235 million that Northwestern has gotten in the last 9 years, and the fact that students don't receive any, can't receive any credits for playing, and they receive over $60,000 in scholarships. What's interesting to note, and I think has been lost in a lot of this debate, is that this decision right now, because Northwestern is a private university, only applies to private universities.
That's right.
So for public universities, say at like Ohio State or Nebraska, they're actually governed by their own state-specific laws on unions and public employees like teachers, firefighters, and police. So it's different in each state there. What's really interesting is that when the decision goes to Washington, to the NLRB federal level, we have to remember that President Obama recently appointed three new members of the NLRB who are more pro-union in their leanings. And so it's unlikely that the national NLRB is going to overturn Peter Orr's decision. What's going to be interesting is how it plays out in federal courts, because as we know, even though this only applies to private universities right now, the NCAA is probably going to take some legal preemptive strikes in friendly federal courts to try to get this struck down.
If you're just joining us, we're having our weekly barbershop roundtable. We're joined by commentator Arsalan Iftikhar. That's who was speaking just now. Also with us, Corey Dade, journalist Corey Dade, healthcare consultant Neil Minkoff, writer Jimmy Israel. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Well, hold on to your seats, because comedian and rapper Nick Cannon, he debuted an alter ego this week, and I know you all were waiting. He donned a blonde wig, flannel shirt, and white face to promote his upcoming album, White People Party Music. And here's Cannon in character. Can we drop that, please?
This guy's good, bro. He's going. He's like freestyle. Someone should sign this guy.
Oh, wow. And not everyone likes the person that Cannon himself calls Connor Smallnut. Critics say Cannon is racist for mocking whites. You know, but I think we buried the lead here. You know, Nick Cannon got a job. Oh, my God.
Another job.
You got a job, man. Hashtag Scarface reference. But, yeah, I think it's brilliant and also schlocky. Obviously, he's desperate. This actor turned rapper turned house husband turned I need to get a job to do something quick. Turned, schlock artist. Yeah, it's whatever. A-Train, Arsalan,
yes,
what do you make of this?
Well, Nick Cannon definitely gets the Redunculus Award of the week in my books because of the fact that, you know, for millions of us who have been trying to get rid of blackface in American zeitgeist culture, I think Nick Cannon actually only helps he actually works against us. I think that for people who do blackface from now on, they're automatically going to say, well, you know, Nick Cannon did whiteface, and so we're justified in doing blackface. I think Nick Cannon could have done the same thing, just donning that blonde wig. I didn't think that he'd have to go as far as the schlocky, as you mentioned, whiteface that he did. I think that, again, people have unconscious biases in us, and I think that, again, you know, whenever we see a fraternity party somewhere, you know, donning blackface, you know, a lot of these people now are going to say, well, you know, if Nick Cannon can do whiteface, then we can do blackface. So I think it's a terrible move on his part.
It's an interesting point. But the fact is, people who want to don blackface don't need Nick Cannon's permission to do it, and they don't really
care.
Right,
but they can use that as justification.
Yeah, but people have been using the justification of rappers for years about, well, rappers use the N-word, so therefore I'm going to use the N-word. And my attitude is, when you start consulting rappers about stock tips and other things that you know, that you care about, then I'll be interested in you. Following their
Wu-Tang
lead
Financial.
On stock, you know, on that question as well. But I don't know.
Michelle. Mm-hmm. I've never been a critic of blackface in the spirit of performance. I mean, it is what it is. If it's satire and you're outraged, then it worked, duh. You know, so I've always been, I guess I'm probably in the minority here. I've always been fairly okay with blackface.
Neil Minkoff. On the satire question, well, that's kind of leads logically to this other question, but I do want to hear what Neil has to say about this. Where are you on?
I'm actually in the same vein. I was going to point out that the problem is that it was done so poorly in a lot of ways. I mean, whiteface does not have the historical baggage that minstrel shows or blackface have, and it's, I think it's silly to equate them, although I can understand the concern. But, you know, look at the brilliance of what Eddie Murphy did in whiteface with his short film White Like Me back in the 80s that did it. It was really funny, but it also had a point, and it was brilliant, and it wasn't this sort of like schlocky, back-of-the-envelope, not really funny bit that Nick Cannon did. It can be done well, and when it's done well, it can be incredibly satirical.
Corey, what do you think? Mm-hmm.
And I will add, Dave Chappelle did it brilliantly, too. I think between Chappelle and Eddie Murphy, there was a profound social commentary that was actually accurate. At the end of the day, it talked about white men's entitlement, the sort of access that they have to better opportunities that blacks don't, and the surprise that these black men around them had at that level of access. In this case, this character that Nick Cannon created is not doing that. And I think it is a false equivalency. I mean, at the end of the day, to Jimmy's point about satire, blackface was meant to demean, but more importantly, it was meant to perpetuate the dehumanization of blacks. If they could get white audiences to continue to see blacks as subhuman and comical, it was a moral justification to continue to discriminate against them. So there's not any of that happening here. And there's no way anyone can bring the two together.
But he is playing on a racial stereotype, a sexual racial stereotype.
Yeah, that part is demeaning.
That's part of it. And,
but this is not an oppressive act.
Okay. Well, speaking of, the satire, I mean, I'm dying to hear what you all think about this. I mean, Stephen Colbert was mocking the owner of Washington's football team who set up a charity to help Native Americans. This is something we talked about on the program yesterday with a columnist, Mike Wise, who's been covering this story. A lot of people consider the name of this team a racial slur, and he set up this charity after a very lengthy letter describing what his motivation was and how he planned to be helpful in the future. Now, this is Stephen Colbert. This is how he spun it, so let's hear that.
Okay. Folks, this move by Dan Snyder inspires me because my show has frequently come under attack for having a so-called offensive mascot. My beloved character, Ching Chong Ding Dong.
Ooh, I love tea. It's so good for you. You're so pretty, American girl. You come here, you kiss my tea, make all sweet. I don't need no sugar when you're around.
So where were you on this one? Jimmy, you want to start?
I'm okay with it. Yeah, it's satire. If you're not outraged, and it didn't do its job. So, yeah, I'm fine with it. It works for me. Mm.
Well, Colt.
Neil?
I thought it was funny how there was a Twitter beef as to whether or not Stephen Colbert was responsible for the tweet or it came from Comedy Central and did he have anything to do with it, which I thought was very strange considering it had already been a bit on the show about satire of people who are okay with racism or who could find a racial stereotype offensive. I thought it was interesting that on Twitter there seemed to be a little bit of a walk back.
Mm. Okay. Okay. Arslan, what do you think?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's interesting. The people who created the Twitter hashtag Cancel Colbert, I think, didn't actually watch the bit. Again, he was, satirizing the lame foundation that Dan Snyder set up, which is called, by the way, the Washington Redskins Original Americans Foundation, which makes me want to vomit. But I think that Colbert was, again, he was enacting a parody against the racist, elitist, right-wing character that he is. And I think that he was actually poking fun at Dan Snyder. I didn't think that he was trying to dehumanize Asian Americans. And I think that people who, took to Twitter in this hashtag, Cancel Colbert, were only getting half of the story right.
Well, but you don't think it, I mean, it's interesting because you thought the whiteface went too far. There are a lot of people who feel like they don't need to hear that. I don't really want to say it, the name of this character. I don't really want to say it because I know that a lot of people just find it upsetting to hear. And so was that really necessary, I think, is the question that could he have gotten his point across without that?
Yeah, I don't think it is necessary.
Go ahead, Corey.
But, you have to ask yourself, is comedy necessary, period? I mean, Colbert's whole shtick, his whole image is to be the faux conservative. And by being the faux conservative, it gives him access to lampoon all conservative ideals and, by extension, racism, et cetera. And that's what he was doing here. In order to do it, he often has sort of almost a sacrificial lamb. In this case, it's Asians. And whether fairly or not, his goal is to actually use that to turn the criticism and, turn hypocrisy and racism on its head.
So you think it's okay? You don't think it's racist?
I don't think his, I think it's offensive to Asian Americans. I think it is. But at the end of the day, his goal wasn't to offend. It was a successful effort.
Okay, we have one more topic we want to get to. And to set the mood, here's a little Wu-Tang Clan. Bam! Move from the gate now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, this is a classic. And so Wu-Tang may be coming into some more cash soon. They say they're going to release just one copy of their next album. It will come with a multi-million-dollar price tag, but they will, you know, let people listen to it. And they say part of the argument here is that music is art, just like, you know, a painting is art. And this is the way people access it. They go on tours. It'll be on display in museums and galleries where people can pay to view it and listen. And then they'll auction it off, and they want to make a point about this. So Arsalan, I know you suggested we should take up a collection here in the shop to see how we can do. And I mentioned that once you pay for my kids' college education, I'll be more than glad to participate and to chip in. But what about it? Arsalan, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to note that I grew up on the crime side, the New York Times side, and staying alive was no jive. But I think that I think that the album should be called the 37th Chamber. But, you know, I am thrilled. I can't wait to hear RZA, GZA, Ghostface Killah, Raekwon, ODB, rest in peace, Master Killah, Method Man, Redman. In this, I think it would be owning like it would this owning one copy would be like owning the sword of Excalibur. I think it's a brilliant, brilliant move.
Corey, what are you doing? Are you chipping in?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, first of all, Redman, you know, Arsalan Redman is not part of the Wu, but that's all right. The Wu coming through, baby. You know, they have always been, especially their leaders, especially RZA and GZA in particular, they've always been artists willing to push to new frontiers. And what's unique about them, they've always had a cultish following among rap fans. So it's no surprise that they're doing this. I think it's as the natural evolution from what Jay-Z did, trying to bring, you know, this is the older generation of hip-hop artists trying to bring the art and the culture back into hip-hop, kind of the answer to the Drakes of the world.
Step light now on that older thing. All
hey,
right.
Hey,
step light.
I'm one step of light. Yeah, yeah. I own it. I'm one of them.
Okay, we got to give one person one last word. Neil, you want it? You want the last
one? Yeah, I would love to have it. In the old days, I remember loving to get a record and put it on the turntable and hold that jacket and look at the art and pull out the sleeve and read the lyrics and the liner notes and I miss that.
And then you jumped into your horse and buggy, right? And
missed that multi-dimensional way of experiencing music, and this takes it to a whole new level. Right. I love this idea.
All right, okay. Neil Minkoff is a healthcare consultant and contributor to National Review with us from Boston. Jimmy Israel is a writer. You can find his blog at jimmyisrael.com with us from Cleveland. Arsalan Iftikhar, founder of the Muslim Guide .com, a senior editor for Islamic Monthly with us from Chicago. Corey Data is a contributing editor for The Root, author of their politics blog, The Take, with us in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much.
Peace.
Yes, sir.
Hey, hey, hey.
Yep.
And if you can't get enough Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for our Barbershop podcast in the iTunes store or at npr.org. That's our program for today. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more on Monday.